We'll continue now into our investigation of the Vedic method of knowledge, Vedic method of philosophy. The theme is, as I explained yesterday, substance and shadow. Substance meaning the spiritual reality, and shadow meaning this material realm of mind and matter. We have to always keep in mind, this is a very important point, that mind itself is also material. And this is one of the great problems. When we speak of, yesterday I explained the word metaphysics, the effort of the mind to rise above the mind. So the mind is material. And philosophy is an enterprise of the mind. So how can we come to the platform of substance or reality, transcendence, by way of the mind, which is material? This is an age-old problem in philosophy. And no less than anyone else, we have to deal with. So for today's talk, I want to look at what for everyone is an inescapable problem. Everyone means devotees, karmis, everybody. Everybody who thinks. There's an inescapable problem. And that is the problem, or you can even say the battle, the internal battle between doubt and certainty. Now, this may all sound to some, you know, this is some kind of very high intellectual conception. But no, it's very practical. It's the same problem that Arjuna had 5,000 years ago at Kurukshetra. You know, in the very first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna's condition, what was it? He became overwhelmed with doubts, which was for him very unusual because he's a Kshatriya. Kshatriya is a warrior. You know, persons of that type of spirit, military, chivalrous spirit, they're generally, that is known, their quality is to be very firm, very unyielding, very convinced about what they do. You know, if anyone has been in the army, you know, that's how they run things. There's the hierarchy of authority, and you are told what to do, and you must do it. You know, like in the American military, there's one branch, the Marines, and they're considered to be very tough. So they have a thing where, you know, the weapon you get. So there are different words in the English language. You can call a weapon a firearm, you can call it a gun. But you're supposed to, in the Marines, you're supposed to only call it a rifle. So this is a rule. Now, you may think, well, what, you know, what's the difference? What does it matter if I call the thing a rifle or a gun? But in this branch, because it's very tough, if the officer or the sergeant hears a new man refer to his weapon as a gun, then he makes that new man is forced to parade. You know, they have their army camp, and there's always a big parade ground in the center. So he's forced to parade back and forth with this weapon on his shoulder, completely naked. And he has to parade back and forth, and he has to shout, "This is my rifle, I called it my gun, and that's why I'm standing naked in the sun." So, you cannot question, you know, you just, that's the military mentality. They say, "This is a rifle, you call it a rifle, if you call it something else, then you're punished." So that's what we typically understand to be military mentality. Arjuna is Kshatriya, Vedic soldier. So Vedic culture is, of course, based on spiritual knowledge, which is absolute, which is certain. And yet, in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna became overwhelmed with doubts. And this is the theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna keeps, Arjuna keeps coming back to his doubts. You follow chapter by chapter by chapter, look at Arjuna's questions. He's having doubts. And what is Lord Krishna telling him? Arjuna, you must slay the demon of doubt. He calls it the demon of doubt, with the weapon of knowledge. So this is the central theme of Bhagavad Gita, doubt and certainty. In the end, what does Arjuna tell to Krishna? Now all my doubts have been overcome. They've been vanquished. Now I'm ready to ride forth in battle. So that is the victory. Of course, the Kurukshetra war, there's a victory. But Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken at the beginning of the Kurukshetra war, already foresees Arjuna's victory in battle, because Arjuna conquers over his doubts and becomes in this way actually victorious. So this is our, as Prabhupada says very clearly, Bhagavad Gita was spoken by Lord Krishna not just to Arjuna. It wasn't that Lord Krishna had one disciple, Arjuna, and we don't hear that Arjuna had any disciples. He was not a spiritual master. So it's not that Krishna had one disciple, Arjuna, and that's the end of the story. You know, Bhagavad Gita, we can learn what Krishna said to Arjuna, but it has no relevance to us. Actually, Srila Prabhupada confirms that Lord Krishna, through Arjuna, is speaking to everyone. Actually, Arjuna is Nitya Siddha, a devotee, eternally liberated devotee. Srila Prabhupada actually explained a very interesting thing about Arjuna. He said that just as Krishna is expanded within every universe, because Lord Krishna's pastimes are moving from universe to universe to universe. So Krishna is always, he's in all the universes. And Arjuna similarly expands. Although we think of Arjuna as being jiva tattva, how is that possible? But it is possible when one becomes dear to Krishna, that wherever Krishna goes, wherever he displays his pastimes, that he wants such a devotee as Arjuna to be with him everywhere. In any universe he might be, simultaneously many universes, Arjuna is there. So, Arjuna, he is actually Nitya Siddha devotee. So his falling into doubt, this is a leela, this is a pastime, but a pastime for our benefit. We are meant to learn from this, to learn from Lord Krishna's instructions to Arjuna. So we are meant, therefore, to come from the position of doubt. And that is this world of shadow. This world of material mind, material and of course matter, subtle mind, gross matter, this world of shadow, is a world of doubt. What is true? What is false? This is why there is philosophy, because there's so much argument. Nobody's really sure, so different philosophers are coming out. I think this, I think this, I think this. Since the beginning of the world, this has been going on. So we're born into that. We're born into duality, Lord Krishna says. Icha dvesha shrutena dvandva mohena bharata. Dvandva means duality. Right, wrong, good, evil, true, false. Dvandva mohena. Mohena means bewilderment. So we are born into this bewilderment. But it is our duty, our responsibility as human beings. It comes with this human body, whether it's a male or female, or Indian or American, Russian, African body, doesn't matter. But if you have a human body, one head, two arms, two legs, then it is your duty, your responsibility, to get out of this doubt to which we have all been born. That means we must go from doubt to certainty. So that is the inescapable problem of philosophy facing each one of us. It is our dharma, it is our duty to move from doubt to certainty. Now, we may think, you know, when I joined ISKCON, so I think like almost everyone, I was very idealistic. I joined very convinced. I mean, to say I'm still convinced, but at that time it was this, Vishwanath Chakravarti calls in his Madhurya Kadambini, he uses this nice phrase, Utsahamaya. He said in the very beginning, one is, you can even say, too enthusiastic. This kind of youthful, immature enthusiasm. And like Prabhupada says, that religion without philosophy is sentimentalism or fanaticism. So this is also a danger in spiritual life. Because if we're too enthusiastic in the sense of being too trusting, too blind in our belief, then we are setting ourselves up for disappointment. We can become disappointed when the harsh realities of life, life in this shadow, catch up with us. And we find that things are not as clear-cut as we thought. Then we may become disappointed. When you study the psychology, you see it's another kind of egoism, another kind of false ego. That in one's enthusiasm, one is thinking, I'm right, therefore everything must be as I see it. What is that? Atmaman midyate jagat. As I see the universe, that is the way it must be. And then when this universe shows us that no, things are different than what you think. There's that phrase from some Shakespearean play there's more in heaven and earth than contained in your philosophy, O Horatio. So, when we realize that if we're on this false ego platform, then we may lose faith completely. Things weren't as what I understood. But as you or I understand, it doesn't have to. It doesn't, just because we think that way, it doesn't mean that it's real. So, yes, religion or belief, faith, has to be matured in scientific thinking, in philosophical thinking. So, there are two things then. There is the doctrine, there is what we learn, and then there is our experience. Our experience of life. Also, logic. Logic means, of course, structured, reasonable thought. You know, we don't think it's very reasonable if someone tells us that the moon... Actually, this is one belief. One belief is there. In China, and maybe also in India, I'm not sure. But children are told that there's a rabbit living in the moon, a big rabbit. You may have heard that. I think it's upside down. If you look at the moon upside down, you can see the shape of a rabbit. In the West, we hear about the man in the moon. Sometimes they say the moon is made out of cheese. I just So this is some explanation of the way things are. But it's not logical. We can't accept it. So, there's the doctrine, there's the teaching, the message of Shastra. But in order to remove our doubts, in order to actually be convinced, then we have to see some correlation between the eternal message of Shastra and our experience and logic. So, we'll be explaining how that is to be done in the days that come. But I'm just now giving some fundamental points here about the challenge facing us in moving from doubt to certainty. We want to see that there's some evidence before we can give our heart to a thing. So, that is done through buddhi, through intelligence. By intelligence, then, our experience, our logic, is matched up very nicely with the eternal message of Shastra. So we don't have that intelligence. We don't come to Krishna consciousness with that intelligence. We have to get that intelligence from authority, from spiritual authority. But we don't have that intelligence, but we do have the tools. You see, it's like we have all that is needed to put together the proper understanding, but we just have to be shown how to do it. So this buddhi has five functions. Srila Prabhupada, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, explains that by the functions of our buddhi, our intelligence, you can actually experience the soul. Now this is the, Prabhupada pointed out, when we talk about doubt and certainty, this is the crux of the whole problem. The crux of the whole problem is, do you actually know that you are not this body? Do you actually know? When Prabhupada was speaking with the scientists, he formed this Bhaktivedanta Institute. So when he would discuss with them science, Prabhupada would always come to this point. And when Prabhupada would speak with his disciples about science, about philosophy, Prabhupada, he would always come to a very direct and personal point. He would talk to that devotee and ask him, do you understand? Not that the scientist is a third person, someone not involved in this discussion, but you are the scientist. And sometimes the devotee would say, no, it is not me, Srila Prabhupada. The scientists are saying, and Prabhupada would, but sometimes in lecture, he would refer to his disciple as rascal scientist. Or what do you have to say, rascal scientist? Because Prabhupada knows, of course, what background we are coming from. Prabhupada used to call the school slaughterhouses. So most of us have come through. We're not so fortunate as to have come out of the Gurukul system. We came through mundane education. So our intelligence was slaughtered. So Srila Prabhupada was showing us directly how to take these elements of intelligence and put them together properly so that we can actually experience that I am not the body. You can actually experience through proper philosophy that you are not the body. And that is, of course, the state of conviction, of certainty. When we know that I'm not this body, then that is called nishta. Nishta means firm, unshakable faith. So we are all meant to come to that platform. That is actually the basic platform of Krishna consciousness. Nishta. So how to do that? So Srila Prabhupada, he writes in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Verse 30, that there are five functions in intelligence. So shankshaya, viparyasya, nishtaya, smriti, and svapa. So it begins with shankshaya. Shankshaya means doubt. Everyone begins on this platform, doubt. Now, doubt is useful. Because if one knows how to use doubt, then just as Arjuna did, one can inquire. One can make inquiry, and in this way, root out all ignorance. We have to be alive in our thinking. So doubting, Srila Prabhupada said we should doubt in this way, not challengingly. And this is the problem. This is the problem in the material world. They make doubt into a philosophy. That's going to be the theme of our class today. The materialists make doubt into a philosophy. No. Though doubt is a feature of intelligence. But doubt is there simply to help us ask questions. Ask the proper questions, the perfect questions to the perfect authority so that we get perfect answers and then doubt is removed. It's the example of Prabhupada. Actually, it's an example that Lord Krishna gives in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada used to often repeat this example. It's taking a branch from the tree and making it into a handle of an axe and then chopping the tree down. So the tree means our material consciousness, our present state of ignorance and doubt. So one has to know how to take a branch from that tree, you know? Positively engage doubt. Take a branch, turn it into an axe handle. The axe head is knowledge, the weapon of knowledge. And then using our doubt and knowledge together. You see, you get knowledge, but you haven't understood it perfectly. So you ask questions. But what about? What about? What about? And then in all of these dark corners of the mind, the spiritual master shines the light of knowledge. You see, the doubt is simply pointing out where the ignorance is, and then he shines the light of knowledge. So in this way, with the axe handle and the axe head, the tree of material existence is chopped down. So this is the proper use of doubt. Not that we make doubt into our philosophy. This is, doubt is one department of intelligence. And then there's smriti, memory, that's another department. Svapa means sleep, dreaming, that's another department. And then there's viparyasya. Viparyasya means to detect the false identity. And then nischaya means to realize the real identity. So one has to know how to put all these together. Then you can realize the soul. So in this little book I wrote, I give some idea how that can be done. So first of all, a person is impelled by sangshaya, doubt, to inquire from a spiritual master how to experience the soul. So in order to do that, in order to become curious, how is it that I'm spirit soul? You must first of all have a doubt that you are the body. You must have a doubt. If you're convinced I am the body, then you're not going to go to a spiritual master. And inquire from him, at least not submissively. You see? There are puffed up people who go to spiritual master to try to defeat him. But they cannot receive the mercy of the spiritual master in that way. So I must first doubt I am the body before I can seriously inquire about the soul. Now, why would I doubt that I am the body? So then we come to the next department, smriti, memory. So here we have a quotation from Srila Prabhupada. The first lesson in spiritual life is that we are not these bodies, but eternal spirit souls. Once you were a child, now you are a grown man. Where is your childhood body? That body does not exist, but you still exist because you are eternal. The circumstantial body has changed, but you have not changed. This is the proof of eternality. You remember that you did certain things yesterday and certain things today, but you forget other things. Your body of yesterday is not today's body. Do you admit it or not? You cannot say that today is the 13th of May, 1973. You cannot say that today is yesterday. The 13th was yesterday. The day has changed. But you remember yesterday. And that remembrance is evidence of your eternality. The body has changed, but you remember it. Therefore, you are eternal. Although the body is temporary. This proof is very simple. Even a child can understand it. So there's doubt, then there's memory. So, besides smriti, the conscious power of recollection, you see, so we remember. We can remember that I was 5 years old or 10 years old. This body has changed. But then someone may argue, well, that's in this lifetime. Actually, in one of Plato's dialogues, a very nice philosophical text from ancient Greece, Socrates is talking with someone who actually has this philosophy. He's admitting that the body changes, but only in this life. He says, no problem, the body changes, but only in this life. In the end of this life, then the soul dies. So Socrates, he gave a very nice reply to this. Anyway, so this may be a doubt. The next doubt, all right. So, there is something changing this body, and I can remember it. I can remember it, so I accept that there is a soul different from the body. But how do I know that before this body, I had other bodies? Because I can't remember those. So, then consider your dreams at night. Srila Prabhupada says that when we dream at night, we are accepting a subtle body, a dream body. For instance, you may dream. This is a common example. You may have a dream that you're being eaten by a tiger. Huh? So, you see in your dream, the tiger leaps out of the underbrush and is biting your neck, and blood is squirting out. And you're dying. You're in intense pain, and you're dying, and the tiger is growling and ripping your throat out. All this you can dream. And it's horrible. So what was that experience? That experience was, you accepted a dream body. You accepted a body of a person whose throat is being ripped out by a tiger. So, Srila Prabhupada says that we've had every night of our life so many dream bodies. How many do we remember? We've forgotten. Maybe you remember the one last night, or some particular stunning dream that you once had some time ago. But every night, every 24 hours, we sleep for some 6 hours, and we dream. And in those dreams, we accept different bodies. Even in the course of one night of sleeping, we have different dreams. Not just one dream. So you can accept a succession of different kinds of bodies, subtle bodies. And then you give them up. Just like the tiger is biting your throat, you wake up. That body is gone. Where's that bloody throat? You go like this. Oh, it's all right. It's not there. It's gone. There's no tiger. There's no torn throat. So it's gone. So we're experiencing that every night. So this is, you see, this is evidence. This is experience. And it is logical. So if we cannot deny that we have accepted every night of our life a succession of subtle bodies. Now you may say, yeah, but those were just dream bodies. But wait a minute. When you're in that body, for you it's real. You can't deny that. You can't deny it. You can say now in waking state, oh, it was just a dream. But when you're having that dream, it's real. And that's the whole point. Now we're having, Prabhupada said, a daydream. We think this body is real. And if this body dies, actually the death is just like the breaking of a dream. And there are people in Western medical science, they've done many investigations of what they call NDE, near-death experience. One book was written in the 80s by one doctor who had many patients who, for some time, 10, 15 minutes, half an hour sometimes, they were clinically dead. Means there were no life symptoms in the body, but yet they were still revived. And they came back with memories, and they're saying, it's amazing. All my life I was thinking that this is real, but what I experienced shows me that this is just a dream. I left this body. They entered some higher state temporarily. And this is, it's interesting that this is all in accordance with our Gaudiya Vaishnava Vedanta philosophy. In the Govinda Bhasya of Baladev Vidyabhusan, he's actually describing these higher levels that one attains when one leaves the body, including meeting what he calls the Archisdeva. Archisdeva means a shining person, a person who's body just looks like light. And this person conducts you. He welcomes you into this plane after death, and then takes you to your next destination. So many, many people who have had these near-death experiences, they come back and say, yes, I met some shining person. I left my body and there was a shining person, but he told me to go back. He said, it's not time now. You go back. So it's very amazing that some 350 years ago, we find Baladev Vidyabhusan has described and given a name to that entity, Archisdeva. So anyway, these persons who have this experience, they're coming back and saying that realm I went to is much more real than this. The colors were much more brilliant. Everything was much more at real substance. And now I feel like I'm in a dream. Now that I've come back to this body. Yes, so actually it's a fact. This, what we're experiencing now, is a dream. And the moment of death is like the breaking of that dream. So this is all very logical. Yeah? We've experienced this every night. Accepting dream body, thinking it to be real, and then giving it up suddenly. And realizing that it wasn't real. So in this way, then one can start to understand, this is viparyasya, one can start to understand that this body is a false identification. It's a false identity. And then, when one considers this very deeply, then one actually comes to the stage of what Lord Krishna calls adhyatma vidya, realization, knowledge of the soul as being different from the mind and the body. This is nishchaya. So, now this process is possible through philosophy, but philosophy just gives us a glimpse. Philosophy gives us a glimpse. Sometimes, you know, we have some philosophical realization, insight. It's a glimpse. But actually the process of bhakti yoga, this establishes us in that realization. Because philosophy, it's theoretical. But bhakti yoga is encompassing not only the theory, not only the doctrine, the theory, but also the practice. So something becomes realized only when we act upon it. And this is bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga, devotional service to Lord Krishna, is the action. We're talking about, I am not the body, I am spirit soul, but this is the actual function of the soul. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada, he said, what is liberation? Citing the Bhagavatam, Muktir hidvanyata rupam svarupene vivashtiti. That is liberation. Liberation is mukti hidvanyata rupa. There is, it means understanding that there is a form, a rup, a form that is other. Anyata means another, different from this. So form means body. Body means senses, Prabhupada said. Senses means activities. So we become established in mukti, in our swarup. Srila Prabhupada said, this is actual swarup, to serve Krishna. You find nowadays people talk about swarup. They're going here and there in Vrindavan to find out what is my swarup. But Prabhupada said, swarup means chanting 16 rounds a day, following four regular principles. You're actually doing it. You're actually living and acting on the liberated platform. Performing spiritual activities. It is practical. So by this activity in liberation, in this way, the swarup is gradually revealed. It is immediately revealed, but because it is, we're speaking of Krishna consciousness, which is an unlimited ocean of nectar, the more one practices bhakti yoga, then the more nectarian it becomes. So yes, there's an unlimited storehouse of nectarian realization, which will be revealed to us. Srila Prabhupada said, when you are ready, Bhakti Dhru Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada, that how will we, after, if you depart from this world, Srila Prabhupada, then how will we come to know our eternal relationship with Krishna, our rasa? And Srila Prabhupada said that when you are ready, I will reveal it. I will come back and reveal it. Because this spiritual master, he does not exist on the mundane platform. As Srila Prabhupada called his own spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Vaikuntha man. The Vaikuntha man. So the spiritual master operates from the transcendental platform within the heart of the disciple. So, but anyway, swarup, or the liberated platform, the function of the liberated soul, begins here and now with these practical affairs of bhakti yoga. So in this way, what we can catch a glimpse of through philosophy, we become established in through bhakti yoga. So, this is how we can go from doubt to certainty. But, as I said, in this world of uncertainty, in this world of maya, there is always a challenge to our conviction, to our belief, to our sentiments. We like to think that, yes, Krishna consciousness, this is the safe and sure way. The Shastra tells us that. But Prabhupada also says that even on the royal road, there is danger of accidents. And if you look in our brief history of ISKCON, we find that there have been some serious accidents. Also with spiritual authorities. Even those devotees who have occupied the post of spiritual master. There has been some unfortunate mishaps, misadventures. So, and we see as a result that there were devotees who were, you know, you can say in a kind of sentimental way, well-meaning but sentimental way, they had placed all their faith in this process, but then some misadventure occurs and they became disheartened, disappointed. And some of them lost faith completely. Or some of them started to make a philosophy out of doubt. You see? And as I'm saying, we're hearing nowadays in our ISKCON movement from different quarters, we're hearing different philosophies. And if you examine them, you will find that they all go back to this point. The root is doubt. The root is cultivation of doubt, turning doubt itself into a philosophy. And then it comes out as, well, you know, you can't trust these gurus, you can't trust the GBC, you can't trust this, you can't trust that. You have to, you know, use your own intelligence. Now, of course, we don't deny that. I just explained how you use your own intelligence, these five functions of intelligence. We must use them. But we must not use them, again, to make doubt into a philosophy. That won't work. As a matter of fact, what we call modern philosophy or modern Western philosophy, that is where it begins. And I think we should all try to understand this. Because as I said today we see on the edges of ISKCON some new philosophies starting to appear. And they're appearing from... I know some of these persons. I'm not going to mention any names, but... I mean, I've known some of these persons for many, many years. So, as I said, when I joined, I was very idealistic. They were very idealistic. Then they became disappointed. Disappointed in authority. Now, in our, you know, devotees in our movement are very intelligent. They're the most intelligent individuals in the whole planet. But at the same time, our devotees can be very inexperienced, because that intelligence is innate. It's there from previous sukrita, pious activities. Very often we see how devotees in this lifetime, they went to school, but they didn't care. They didn't, you know, I would say more often than not, our devotees are in that category. They went to school, but they really didn't care. They may have been actually very poor students. Not because they were unintelligent, but because they didn't like this nonsense. They naturally, by intuition in the heart, they could understand, this is just foolishness. Why should I waste my time to learn this? So, that's all right. That's actually very good. But, there's something we have to face. That we're inexperienced. So I've seen how persons, you know, they have a little disappointment with some authority, and then they start to speculate. They get a doubt, and they start to nurture that doubt. And from out of that doubt comes some new realizations. Ah, very new insight. See, and they were trying to hide this from me. But now I've seen myself what's really going on. You see? And they become very, very fired up, thinking this is something new. But it's not new. This type of thought process, it is as old as the world. And that's what we miss, you see, when we are sleeping in our classes in school. We miss the fact that this is an old story in history. There's nothing new. And actually the whole of what we call modern philosophy comes out of this same type of disappointment with authority. So I just want to explain that. So, as you know, what we call Western civilization, which is certainly the predominant civilization and culture in the world, even here in India, although Indian culture is originally Vedic, but especially since the time of the British in India, Western ideas and Western culture, the whole Western approach to life, has become very well established here today. And, you know, the Vedic culture, Vedic knowledge, it is less relevant. Well, there are many people in India who respect it, but when you talk about their practical life, what they do in their practical life, they're actually following Western culture. So Western culture is the predominant culture. Now, where does it come from? Where does it start? So basically, it has two sources. The culture of ancient Greece and Rome. Really, we mean Greece. Rome was just a kind of parasite of Greece, a Greek culture, and Christian culture. So, Greek culture and Christian culture. This is the soil out of which our Western European American civilization has grown up. So, now this ancient Greek and Christian culture. This was also used to depend on authority, hearing from authority. Just as we know, the Vedic culture, and we'll be explaining this further, the actual praman means evidence, is shabda, what you hear from Guru Shastra Sadhu. That is the real evidence, the real basis of all knowledge. So in old Western culture, the same principle was there. But then, it's an interesting coincidence, about the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the West, they started to become disappointed with that system of authority, the system of hearing and accepting from some type of, you know, spiritual master, guru. They may not have used those words, but that was the same. The same principle was understood. So they became disappointed with that, and then they started to speculate on the basis of doubts. So I'd just like to give an example. We're talking about philosophy. So when you go into European culture, you know, you read all these thick old European books, you often find there, they're referring to some person they call the philosopher. You know, they're very often, you'll find these old writers, they'll be explaining something and then they'll say, as the philosopher said, and then they give a quote. And then when you read this, you wonder, well, who is this philosopher? So that philosopher was Aristotle. Aristotle was a philosopher of ancient Greece. He was a disciple of Plato, who was a disciple of Socrates. So Aristotle, in European culture, was so well established that they just referred to him as the philosopher, as if there was no other philosopher. You just had to say the philosopher. Just like also in India, Shankaracharya. Everyone has heard of Shankaracharya, the original Mayavadi philosopher. So he's often referred to as the Bhasyakar, because he wrote a Bhasya to the Vedanta Sutra, Shariraka Bhasya. So also in Indian, they say the Bhasyakar has said. And then you may wonder, who's that Bhasyakar? Shankaracharya. So also in the West, philosopher meant Aristotle. So Aristotle, he was actually the first, what they call polymath. Polymath means he gave knowledge for all departments, for physics, for chemistry, for biology, for astronomy, and of course for philosophy, metaphysics. He gave a whole, you could say, encyclopedia. So then in the Christian era, there were scholars. They were actually known as the scholastics, or the schoolmen, who founded the first universities. I believe the first university in Europe was in Paris, and then not far later was the University of Heidelberg, and then in Oxford. So these famous universities were founded in the medieval times by Christian scholars, scholastic schoolmen, and they were all disciples of Aristotle. So they kind of Christianized Aristotle's system, and they were teaching it. They were teaching it as absolute truth. You see, and if you went to university, you learned Bible and you learned Aristotle side by side, and that was it. You see, so this was going on for centuries. And this type of just learning from authority. The philosopher has said, you learn it. That's all. And then, but at some point, some persons, you know, they started to do their own little experiments, their own little investigation. So then they started to find out some peculiar contradictions. They read in Aristotle in his biology, he has written that women have less teeth than men. So someone, sometime in the Middle Ages, they turned to their wife and they said, open your mouth. And then they counted. And then wait a minute. She has the same number of teeth as me. And then they began to wonder, who is this out of Aristotle? He had two wives. Why didn't he ever count their teeth? Why did he put in his book that women have less teeth than men? And so in this way, doubt started. And then they started to investigate more, and then they found more contradictions, more contradictions, more contradictions. And then you come to just about contemporary time as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this French philosopher René Descartes. So Descartes, he's called the father of modern philosophy. The father of modern philosophy. That means all that is going on now in terms of philosophy and science, it can all be traced time as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this French philosopher René Descartes. So Descartes, he's called the father of modern philosophy. The father of modern philosophy. That means all that is going on now in terms of philosophy and science, it can all be traced back to this René Descartes. And René Descartes, he had a couple, you could say, sutras in the Latin language. One of them was De Omnibus Est Dubitantum, which means doubt is everything. You can throw out your scripture, your shastra, your authorities. Doubt is everything. You must start with doubt. And you must build on doubt. And he is very interesting kind of logic, because he said doubt is the only thing you cannot doubt. And by doubt, you know that you exist. You see? He had this other sutra, cogito ergo sum, which means I think, but actually what he really meant, not just thinking, he meant doubting. I doubt, therefore I am. Because by doubting, you know you exist. You see? So doubting confirms that you exist. So by doubt, you know, I am. So then that I am, that is the beginning of knowledge. You can be sure you exist. And then what else can you be sure of? You can only be sure of things that go on up here, that are produced out of doubt. You see? So His best example of that was mathematics. So he said everything has to be understood in terms of mathematics. That is certain knowledge. So, and that's what we have today. And that's what we have today. All of our philosophy, all of our logic, all of our science in the modern world, it is based on mathematics. You know? They talk about, for instance, they talk about things like electrons and neutrons and these things, atoms and so on and so forth. How do they... Now they teach them in school as if they are real objects. But nobody has seen them. Nobody has seen them. So how do they know? How are they so convinced? Because there is mathematical evidence. It must be true. It adds up. You see? It adds up.
So all of this comes from this René Descartes. That, you see, before him, knowledge was received from higher authority. After him, knowledge was something that you have to work out yourself. You start with doubt, not accepting what anyone tells you. No, I can't accept it. And then you have to study it yourself and speculate and, you know, use mathematics. And then you come to an answer. So this is the trend of modern philosophy. But there are some big, big problems with that. Very, very major problems. One of the problems is that, you know, it may sound like a word game when I explain it to you, but actually it's a very, very fundamental criticism of this type of speculation. That if you say that doubt is everything, if you say that, this is a paradox, actually. The statement is a logical paradox. It's a vicious circle. Because if you say doubt is everything, then you've just answered what everything is. And there's no more doubt. But, you know, then when you consider that, well, doubt is everything. So then there's no more doubt. But then how can this doubt is everything be true? Then again you come back to doubt. You see, you go from certainty back to doubt. And when you consider the statement again, you go to certainty again. So in this way, you just go around and around in a circle. Huh? And so as I said, this may just sound like some silly word game. But no. What it actually shows is that by our logic, you know, logic means some kind of pattern of thought, structured thought, going from one point to next point to next point to next point. So by a logic, you cannot actually arrive at truth. All logic is like that. All logic, all language too, it's been said. It's just games, word games. We use words, someone used words in his way, someone else uses words in his way, and he's thinking he's right, he's thinking he's right. But what does it really mean? What does it mean to go beyond the symbols, the words and the numbers, and get at the actual substance? We come back to this problem again of substance and shadow. We were just dealing with the mind. Huh? But where is the reality of it? So you say doubt is everything. You've just answered what everything is. Everything is doubt. So then there's no more doubt. You see, but no, doubt is it's nonsense. Actually, it's actually nonsense. So in when you use computers, you know, sometimes computers get hung up. You know, they freeze. Why do they do that? Because it enters into a logical loop, just like that. Doubt is everything, everything is doubt, round, 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 round. And it gets stuck, and it can't go beyond that point. So what must be done? Someone outside the computer has to reset the whole computer. You see, the operator, the one who's using that logic, he has to reset it. So this indicates that truth, reality, is something outside of logic. Logic just goes around in some circle. There's this term, vicious circle, just chasing around in circle. But the actual truth is outside. Huh? So we can use logic to explain things, but logic itself is not truth. So this is one of the big problems with modern philosophy. And there are other problems. I mentioned them in my talking from the introduction, and I give some quotes from modern scientists. I'll just read them. There's one quote here from a very famous physicist named Stephen Hawking. Quantum physics. This is the most developed type of physics today. So these physicists, they're inventing so many theories. These are all logical constructions. You know, so many, many figures and numbers on the blackboard, you know, and they're proving this and proving that, all in theory, all in formulas. But what is the actual substance of the whole thing? So I'm quoting one big, big physicist, Stephen Hawking. He's very famous. You may have heard of him. He's the one in the wheelchair. He talks through a computer. So he's writing that all of this quantum theory, his own subject that he's working on, he says it's about, he's asked, what is this that you're working on? He says, I'm working on that which I do not know and cannot prove. So what is he doing? He's building castles in the sky. See, but he's a famous man. And then it goes on to say, it is generally agreed that in science nothing can ever be proved. This is a basic principle in modern science, that nothing can ever be proved. What you can, all that you can say is about something that it is, has not been disproved. You know, that's how scientific theories are accepted. Not because they've been proved. The theory of evolution has not been proved. But just that they don't have enough brain to disprove it, that's all. Of course, our Bhaktivedanta scientists, Bhaktivedanta Institute of Science, they're disproving it. But among the materialists, they can't disprove it. So therefore, it's accepted. But this type of proof, it is not proof at all. It's called an argument from ignorance. If someone argues, this is in standard logic, that if somebody argues that because something has not been disproved, therefore it must be true, this is considered a logical fallacy. It's not good logic. It's stupid. And the opposite, if something has not been proved, and therefore you say it's untrue, this is another kind of fallacy. So actually, this is all going on the mental plane. The whole of modern philosophy, science, it's all just existing on the mental platform. And this all comes out of this idea that I think, therefore I am. Like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Reality is what we think. But the Vedic philosophy, the Vedas tell us that the mind is not the self. He's saying, I think, therefore I am. In other words, he's saying, I am the mind. But the mind is not the self. What is the self? The soul. And the soul is compared to a flame. Prabhupada gives this example. So when the flame is burning cleanly as a soul in Krishna consciousness, then there's no smoke. But when the flame is burning uncleanly, in other words, the soul is in Maya, then it becomes shrouded in smoke. And what is that smoke? The smoke is the mind. The mind is created out of consciousness. It's very closely associated with consciousness, like smoke is. They say, where there's smoke, there's fire. Huh? So where there's mind, there must be a soul. But the two are different, just like smoke is not the fire. What does smoke do? It covers the fire. So our mind actually covers our pure consciousness, our spiritual consciousness. And the mind is subject to the influence of the three modes of material nature. Therefore, sometimes, you see, speaking of our existence on the mental platform, sometimes we're awake. That's sattva, sattva guna, to be awake. Sometimes we're dreaming. According to Bhagavatam, Vedanta philosophy, the svapna state is raju guna, mode of passion. And sometimes we're in shushupti. Shushupti means deep sleep, dreamless sleep. That's the mode of ignorance. So the mind is always going through these three cycles. The mind is always, in this way, subject to the three modes of material nature. So therefore, if you say, I think, therefore I am, you see, you're talking about one state of the mind in the mode of goodness when we're awake. When we're awake, then we think. Sometimes even we don't think. This is not a very good philosophy to say, I think, therefore I am. What about when you're not thinking? Then what? You don't exist? And so, like when you dream at, when you sleep at night, you enter this susupti state. So there's no thought at all. So what does that mean? That you don't exist? It's not a good, not a good logic. So the actual fact is that we are spirit soul. So just like the flame is always burning, but it's creating smoke. So sometimes through the smoke, sometimes the smoke is very less. You can clearly see the flame. Then sometimes the smoke is half obscuring the flame. You can see a little bit of flame through the smoke that we can compare to the mode of passion or dreaming state. And then sometimes the smoke is so dark you can't see the flame at all. Mode of ignorance, completely obscured. But that doesn't mean that the flame is not there. The flame is must be there. Where there's smoke, there's fire. There could not be this activity of the mind if there was not the soul. So this is the point. But this you can only understand, again, through Vedic authority. So we have to, we have our doubts, our mind full of doubts. We've been born with that. But these doubts have to be cleared by the light of Adhyatma Vidya, light of spiritual knowledge, which we receive from Guru Parampara. So this is the subtitle of my book, The Vedic Method of Knowledge. This is the method of knowledge. That you take your doubts, just as Arjuna did to this, to Lord Krishna, you take your doubts to the spiritual master, to Guru Shastra Sadhu, and you have these doubts removed by the proper method. But if we cling to doubt, you see, we say, no, doubt is everything. You see? This is the modern process of knowledge. That I cannot accept authority. I can only accept my doubts. This Srila Prabhupada called the attitude of challenging. We should put questions, submissive questions, before the spiritual authority. But if our questions are challenging, then one can never advance. One will always remain on the platform of doubt. And you see, that's the modern enterprise. All of these modern institutions of so-called knowledge, the universities, the scientific institutes, this is the game they're playing. This is why they say that in science nothing can ultimately be proved. And they want to keep it that way. Because they want to hold on to their professions. They're professional mental speculators. And they want to preserve that system. That is why they're very uncomfortable when they meet devotees. Because devotees are telling them that this is the truth, and this is illusion, and that is the finality of things. That is the siddhanta. We use this word siddhanta. Means that is the final conclusion. They don't want a final conclusion, because that means they're all out of a job. Because their profession is to go on speculating. Prabhupada said, one philosopher will come out and say, this is like this. And then, you know, half a year later, and usually it's his former disciple. Like you find, this goes back to, I mentioned this disciplic succession of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And you, when you study their writings, you find each one was criticizing the one before. So, they're not real disciples. They just take something, take some knowledge, and then they rearrange it to make their own name. So this is the enterprise of mundane knowledge. So they cannot bear that there will be an ultimate truth, a final certainty, a final explanation, because then they're all out of jobs. So therefore, this is the actual reason why, you know, doubt is everything. Yes, that's that is nectar for them. Doubt is everything. Very nice. Then we can just go on speculating. Whatever any teacher says, I can doubt that, I can come forward with my own idea. No, he's wrong, this is the way things are. Then I will become famous, I will get the garland, I will, you know, for my 15 minutes, and then someone will come and push me out of the limelight and take over. And this is the way it goes. And when you really start to study these so-called authorities, mundane authorities, you find it's a circus. It's really pathetic, actually. I point out in in my book about Einstein's theory. How did Einstein's theory become accepted? It's very interesting. Einstein, his theory was simply a product of his imagination. It actually was a product of the times. It's a theory of relativity. It means, in other words, there's no absolute. Everything is related to everything else. There's no absolute truth. So it just depends on your point of view. What you think is real just depends on your point of view. That's his idea. Anyway, so how did Einstein's theory become accepted? It became accepted because, you see, Einstein, he was, I think he was a postal clerk or something. He used to work in the post office, and in his spare time he used to do mathematics and write articles for physics magazines. But he was not a very well-respected scientist. But he had interesting ideas, and these ideas got published. So then one big British scientist named Eddington, he got interested in Einstein's ideas. He thought, well, this is interesting speculation. So then he thought he would promote Einstein's theory. So then he set up a very elaborate experiment to test Einstein's theory of relativity. I'm not going to explain all the details, you'll just find it boring. But I just want to say it was very elaborate. It involved observatories set up to see the eclipse of the sun in 1919. One of the observatories was set up in some African jungle at great expense. Another one, I think, was in South America. So he made this whole incredible arrangement to test Einstein's theory. And because Eddington, at that time, he was a very famous scientist, so whatever he said would be accepted. So he, after running this experiment, he came out and he said, Einstein's theory is true. I have the proof. And then those newspapers from that time, suddenly all around the world, all the big newspapers were saying, relativity has been proved. There, all these articles explain, because people didn't know what it was. So they're explaining, now the way things actually are. Relativity. There's no absolute perspective. Everything is just relative. As you see things, that's your truth. As somebody else sees things, that's his truth. There's no absolute truth. And everyone's going, wow, far out. Amazing. So much speculation was encouraged by that. But how did Eddington actually prove Einstein's theory? So when you go back to the work he did, you find he didn't prove it at all. Not at all. Actually, the results that he got from his observation completely disprove relativity. But what he did was, because he himself was already convinced about relativity, he interpreted all the findings through relativity. In other words, he was saying like, this observation, this photograph of the eclipse, this we cannot accept. There was some defect in the telescope at the time or whatever. Now, why did he say that it was defective? Because it didn't correspond to the result that would have been, if relativity was right. So he was accepting that relativity is correct. So only those findings, there was very few, about 20%, actually supported relativity. All the 80% he kicked out. So this is called, you call this presupposition. He already had his presupposed idea of things, and he interpreted everything through that. So this is dishonest, This is seeing the world through colored glasses, You want to prove that everything is red. So it's very nice proof if you take some red colored glasses and you put them, see, everything is red. The red is coming from your angle of vision, your particular way of seeing things. So, as I'm saying, when one goes into these theories and where they come from, you actually see how they're all arising out of speculation. It's just a big industry. Different speculators churning out so many different theories, and by hook or by crook, by cheating. And now you can start to, I've explained this about how Einstein's theory was accepted, became accepted. And you can now perhaps better appreciate why Srila Prabhupada was so intolerant of these scientists, why he called them all cheaters and rascals, because that is exactly what's going on. It is exactly what is going on. When you dig, when you investigate, you find it's all just a bunch of cheating. You see, there's this German term, Zeitgeist. You see, just the mood of the people is right for relativity to become, you know, just like some Hollywood film, you know. Or some type of music suddenly becomes the hit and everybody is dancing to this kind of music. So it's the same thing in scientists, among scientists. Someone comes out with a new theory, everybody, oh boy, that's really far out. And and it just becomes the mode, you know, the accepted thing. So, yeah, this is material knowledge. All right, so I guess we'll... what time is it? Oh, 20 minutes over time. Sorry about that. So tomorrow, we're going to go on to the question of experience, what we experience through the senses, and how that is to be understood through Vedic knowledge. And how if we don't understand it through Vedic knowledge, we become completely misled. We end up in the darkness of ignorance. So I'll stop here. Are there any questions? Yes?
You mentioned these five types, levels of intelligence, how we use them properly.
Yes.
On the other side, we hear Krishna saying in Bhagavad Gita that Arjuna, that he should surrender. Mm-hmm. Now, is that surrender a shortcut, or is that implying that he has to use his intelligence in these levels?
Well, Krishna is the origin of our intelligence. So to surrender to Krishna means to surrender your intelligence to Krishna. Krishna is giving in Bhagavad Gita instructions how to use your intelligence. That is called buddhi yoga. Huh? So when we speak of surrender, it doesn't, you know, it's not just blindness, you know. It's not like they have this funny expression in philosophy it's a criticism of certain kind of philosophers, idealistic philosophers, who say you can't trust your senses, so completely ignore the senses. So there's a criticism that don't put out your eyes in order to see better. That's not the process. To surrender to Krishna does not mean putting out your eyes in order to see better, or throwing away the intelligence in order to become more intelligent. That's not what it means to surrender to Krishna. What it means to surrender to Krishna is, as he says in Bhagavad Gita, Ham Savasya Prabhu Matak Sarvam Pravartite, everything comes from me. So our senses come from Krishna, our mind comes from Krishna, our intelligence comes from Krishna, our power of speech comes from Krishna. So what does Krishna want us to do with those? That is what it means to surrender to Krishna. To ask, what does Lord Krishna, why did he give me this intelligence? Not that I just kick it out. But what is this intelligence? Just throw it away. Now I'm a Krishna Bhakta. No brain. No. Prabhupada used to criticize it. He used to speak of the so-called sadhus, you see, they're just begging. Huh? They're just begging. You go to holy places, you see, that's their profession. They just stand on the street and they beg. Especially they see nice, you know, Western pilgrim. They're coming. And Prabhupada would say, what is their realization? Why are they standing in the street and begging? They'll say, Prabhupada speaking sarcastically, he said, they'll say that everything, meaning Krishna consciousness, God consciousness, is in the heart. Everything in the heart, nothing in the hand. You see? And therefore, he ridiculed one so-called sadhu, famous in Bengal, who used to say that if someone tries to put money in my hand, you know, to give me money, then my hand immediately goes away. But Prabhupada said, no, my hand immediately, automatically takes the money. and spends it for Krishna. You see? So, serving Krishna means know how to use things in Krishna's service. Not just being so-called renounced or living by begging just to fill the belly and that's enough. You know, this type of living very simply. This type of living very simply means that one does not know how to use the intelligence. One does not know how to use Lakshmi in Krishna's service. Prabhupada was praised in Vrindavan. He was gathered together with his disciples. And he was speaking about how he had tried to serve his spiritual master. He had no other intent in his life except somehow or other carry out the order of his Guru Maharaj. And so one of his disciples said, "And I think you have accomplished this in grand style." And Prabhupada smiled very brightly. He said, "Yes, grand style." And that is Srila Prabhupada's mood. You see, to serve Krishna in grand style, because Krishna is the grandest of all. Just consider Krishna, Lord Krishna's opulence. Is Krishna living in a mud hut? You see? Is Krishna wearing one, lungi like some rickshaw walla? No, Krishna is the origin of all opulence. He's Bhagavan. So therefore Krishna's devotee, he knows expertly, just as Krishna, the spiritual world is the most expert, the most wonderful display of opulence. So similarly, Lord Krishna's devotee is expert in using Krishna's opulence in his service. And so intelligence is an opulence. It's an opulence given us by God. So to surrender to Krishna means to use that intelligence in his service. Not to just turn it off and become a zombie. So that is actual surrender. Any other question? Yes?
You were mentioning mind when we spoke about this doping process, and that at the same time there were mentioned also those five features of intelligence or five processes. So I just want to ask, what are the functions of each of mind, and what are the functions of intelligence in this whole process of doubting and thinking and trying logics and stuff like that?
Well, according to the Bhagavatam, first there's false ego. You see, first the soul has a desire other than to serve Krishna. So from out of that, false ego is manifest. That means a separate identity from that of a devotee. Devotee is one who serves Krishna, but when we desire otherwise, then immediately there's another identity. So that is the basis, ahankara, false ego. Then false ego transforms into the mind. What is the mind? The mind is where these desires start to manifest in our consciousness. So it's just the next stage of false ego, mind, where feelings arise, feelings and thoughts and plans. And then intelligence is called the vijnana rupini of the mind. It's just another form of the mind, another aspect of the mind, by which the mind deliberates, the mind analyzes. You see, you have your desires, you have some interest to do something to satisfy your desires. But then you have to study, you have to plan, you have to analyze in order to satisfy your desires. So that's done by intelligence. So we're speaking about what is called chetana, contaminated consciousness, which has three features, ahankara, manas and buddhi, or false ego, mind and intelligence. And then there's these five functions within the intelligence, which are, doubt, and then memory, and plans, in order to satisfy our desires, which are coming out of the mind. And why do we have desires coming out of the mind? Because we have a separate identity, a false ego. We're thinking ourselves to be something other than Krishna's service. So it's all interrelated. These are, you can just say, the features of contaminated consciousness. These different functions. Any other questions? Yes?
You said that when we sleep, we actually sleep in a state of ignorance. So on the other side, you said that in the
you have the concept of karma. Mm-hmm. How is possible this?
Yeah, that's a feature of Paramatma. You see, the Lord is the Lord of the Jiva, and he's also, the Paramatma is also the Lord of the Jiva, but he's also the Lord of matter. So the Jiva is called the Paramatma's Chid Shakti. Chid means is the energy of consciousness. And matter is called Achid Shakti, the energy of ignorance. So the Jiva in the deep sleep is merged together with the Achid Shakti. Chid and Achid Shakti become merged together. It's just like when Mahavishnu breathes in all the universes, so everything comes into his body. And that is a state of Sushupti also. Everything becomes more or less like void. So when you experience this dreamless sleep at night, it's the same thing. You're being withdrawn into the Achid Shakti of the Paramatma. So it's a kind of, you can say it's a kind of Brahman realization, but it's Brahman realization in the mode of ignorance. any other question? Yes?
Another question. It's about desires. So Jiva or itself is known to be independent by its ability to desire, also independently, you know. And this is called its freedom to desire. And at the same time, when we hear that those Vrijabhasi, they're living in Polidam and they are performing sexual activities, and then they go back to Godhead, and it said that Krishna, they are fortunate that Krishna purifies their desires. So it means that he's like taking away this independence, desire independently also, or what the way for heavens.
No, you mean, first of all, if they are Vrijabhasis, then they're prominent desire is to serve Krishna, is to be Krishna conscious. But they still have lingering material desires, which give them trouble. They have still bad habits. Srila Prabhupada said, we have our first nature and our second nature. Our first nature is our spiritual nature. Our second nature is habit. So, you know, one may know so many things theoretically, but still we have our bad habits. You see, and they're very, very difficult to overcome. So by his mercy, Lord Krishna, he's allowing such devotees, as you mentioned, to exercise their bad habits. Now, it's not that, Prabhupada explained, it's not that they go directly back to Godhead. Someone who is committing sinful activities in the holy Dham, there is a reaction, they have to take birth in the Dham again, but in lower forms of life. But then in that form, you see, there's no more deliberate sinful activities. There's because they're in a lower form. So, therefore they live out that last form, and then they can go back home, back to Godhead. But, you see, this is an example of Krishna's mercy. Also, they're going back home, back to Godhead. I mean, you can think about it. If someone takes birth in the holy Dham as a plant, as a tree, then that's the Shantaras. So, when they're transferred back home, back to Godhead, they're in that state of consciousness. That's only Shantaras. So, this is not an advisable practice. You know, this is not something that we should think, oh, yeah, it's very easy. I can do any nonsense in the holy Dham, and anyway, I'll just take birth as a tree or a bird, and then go back home, back to Godhead. Actually, in this line, in this sampradaya, we are intended to achieve the higher states of rasa, but that you can only do by deliberate effort. You see, you have to make endeavor to do that, to control your senses, become purified.
So the main explanation is that there is a major desire to be Krishna conscious, and those are the bad habits.
Yes.
It could be of them, lower possible karma.
Yes. All right, I think I should stop this because we're way over time now. So again, come back tomorrow, same time, same place, and then we will be looking at our experience, our sense perception, and how that is to be used in Krishna's service and how it is not to be used. Okay. Hare Krishna.